This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research.
As a kid growing up in post-World War II Queens, H. Russell Bernard dreamed of traveling the world and seeing the wonders he read about in books. So as soon as he could, he left home to explore and found his calling in foreign languages and cultures. As a cultural anthropologist, Bernard has studied communities in Greece, Mexico, and the United States, trying to find out why languages die and how our social networks work. Most recently, he has partnered with physicists and mathematicians to refine the methods anthropologists use to analyze the world. H. Russell Bernard is a professor emeritus of anthropology at the University of Florida. He was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2010.
I'm Russ Bernard, Harvey Russell Bernard, and I go by Russ. And I was elected in 2010. I'm at the University of Florida. And a cultural anthropologist, and I was trained as a cultural anthropologist and a linguist.
Where did you grow up?
Well, the neighborhood was called Sunnyside. Still is. And it's, I grew up at near the corner of 46th Street and Queens Boulevard in Queens. And there was a train, an elevated train, and the L was the station was called Bliss Street, which was the old name, and that's 46th Street, and that's right there. It was a neighborhood of buildings that were built in apartment buildings from the 20s and 30s, and it was a multi-ethnic neighborhood. My father was a haberdasher. It's a word that you don't hear much these days. Harry Truman was a haberdasher. That's men's clothing. Sort of everything but suits, but men's clothing. And he worked in stores, and then when I was a teenager, just getting ready to go to college, he opened his own store with a partner. And I grew up working on the floor in the store. Like the holidays, you know, the big Christmas and Valentine's Day and Father's Day, those big sales days for menswear. So that was all part of it growing up. I liked to play ball on the street, stick ball on the street a lot. And in those days you could do that. But I loved to read. That was a big deal. And of course, it will not come as a surprise to anyone from that generation who remembers it, but you know, the big book of marvels was this big attraction to any young person who was growing up and had all these, it gave you dreams of traveling and going into exotic places and seeing all kinds of things all over the world. And that was one of my favorite books, and that and I also love to listen to music, many different kinds. I had an aunt who doted on me, and she gave records, these 78 RPM records, whole collections of them that took lots of time to put on a changer and go run through all these symphonies. And
when did you find anthropology?
Oh, well, so like most people of my generation, I found anthropology by accident. It wasn't something you grew up saying, gee, when I grew up, I want to be an anthropologist. I mean, many of my peers did grow up saying, I want to be a chemist. I want to go to engineering school. I want to do this or that. You know? I had a wanderlust, a terrific wanderlust. As I said, that you know, that big book of marvels as a child, and you wanted to go away and see stuff. So I did, as soon as I could. And I went to various places. I went to Right. You know, when I was in college, I started out as a journalism major, then I switched to biology, and then it was something else, and so it was that kind of thing where people would say, "So, Russ, what are you majoring in this semester?" You know, just searching around, looking for things. But it was great fun to do that. They get all these different professors, right? And it must have been something like 58 or 59, I went to Mexico, and I went to study Spanish. I can remember it vividly. And I spent that whole summer learning Spanish. And I was pretty good at languages. I enjoyed it and picked up a lot of Spanish, and then traveled around Mexico, you know, hitchhiking as best I could to get around the villages and whatnot. And that's it. I just discovered that there was something that I wanted to be a writer. I was in journalism and creative writing, but I realized I just didn't have much to write about. And this just was a big eye-opener. There were all these wonderful things in these communities and people with different lives. And I spoke some Spanish at that time, and people were open. And I was really fascinated by all those things that I was seeing and just wanted to go back. And I said, that's it. I'll go back and I'll major in this thing. Anthropology is it. And so for my last couple of years, last year or so, I picked up a lot of the credits, and that was it. Like, it found me, kind of. The wanderlust didn't go away in college. So at the very end of my college career, with one semester left, I had an opportunity. It came up because my father knew somebody who knew some. Anyway, I had an opportunity to go to sea, and this would have taken me to Europe, where I would be able to see other things. So it was sort of like hitchhiking on a ship, but this was a Liberty ship. Kind of, there aren't any around anymore, but they were built during the war. And after the war, they were picked up by entrepreneurs, sold off by the government, picked up, and they became commercial freighters. And many were owned by Greeks. And I went to sea, and I was a total out and back, something like 3 months at sea. And in those 3 months, I learned Greek. Well, there were 29 Greek sailors, Greek-speaking sailors, and many of them spoke English, but many didn't. And so I picked up some books. They had books, the officers had books to learn English for their exams, for officers' exams. And so the Greek books just worked backwards, right? For Greeks to learn English. And so I had a great time, came out speaking a little Greek, but then one thing led to another, and so when I went to graduate school, I studied Greek, and eventually did my doctoral dissertation in Greece on an island, Kalymnos, it's called. It's in the Dodecanese, 90 miles north of Rhodes. I went there, did my doctoral dissertation research on the sponge fishermen of that island, which at that time, it was a disappearing occupation, because synthetic sponges were wiping out the market for natural sponges around the world. So these folks were an endangered species in terms of their livelihood. I went there to do research and, of course, learned a lot more Greek.
Let's backtrack a little bit. It's not entirely common for someone to want to go off and immerse themselves in all these different kinds of lives, right, and different cultures. So what did your family think of what you decided to do?
Well, they were very supportive, really. It was much more difficult for Carol's family. I mean, she's going to marry an anthropologist. What does that mean? Going to go live in a hut somewhere? You know, will there be running water? Will there be disease? Will you be able to have children? Will you take children with you? Will you endanger them? And indeed, we went with little babies to Mexico and to Greece. Our older daughter was 2 months old when we went to Cottonwoods for the first time. And during the winter, there were two boats a week to that island. So it was pretty isolated.
So tell me about how you met Carol.
That's a nice story, actually. I was 15. She was 14. And she was living in the Bronx. I almost needed a visa to get to the Bronx. It was really way out there for somebody and without a car as a kid. So, but I was with a group of boys, and one of her friends organized a party. Carol's friend knew one of my friends and asked him to come to this party and bring three or four other boys. And so we did. We got there. Everybody paired up immediately to go and dance. And Carol had hurt her leg that day, so she didn't come to the party. So there was one extra boy, and that was me. So I said, okay, I'm just getting on a bus and going home. It's an hour and a half. I'll just spend my time getting on these two buses and going back to Queens. And her friend said, don't do that. Wait, I have her phone number. Why don't you sit in this other room and call her? Well, in those days, you know, telephones were intimacy training devices. So we spent about an hour and a half on the phone. And at the end, I asked her out. And this January, 6 years later, we were married in 62. So we celebrated 50 years just a couple months ago.
So, well, you were inspired by this book of marvels, and then you were actually going out there and doing field work. Did you find that it was what you'd hoped for?
More. Yeah, more. Anthropology has one of our great predecessors said, one foot in the humanities, one in the sciences. The most scientific of the humanities, the most humanistic of the sciences. And that's what it is. It's this combination for me of the unending uniqueness of humanity, with every individual as a story, right? But the unique stories pile up and have patterns, and it's the patterns, the discovery of the patterns, that's the science. It's a community in Mexico, Ixmiquilpan, and it's the center of Otomi, Mezquita Otomi. There's several different groups of Otomi-speaking people. The biggest population is the Mezquita Otomi, the Mezquita Valley, which is about 100 miles north of Mexico City. I noticed that the Otomi people, were not teaching their children Otomi. Now, this is in the 1960s. And they are not very supportive of programs to get the language written in schools. And I wanted to know why. The why turns out to be something that you can see all over the world. The diminishing of the number of native speakers of non-written languages. And I became interested in this in this particular case, and then you could see it in every other case all over the world. The people would simply say, I don't want my children to have to be marked as Indians. It'll hurt them if they speak this language. Well, but they could be bilingual. No. I want them to speak Spanish and only Spanish. Well, guess what? There are lots of people with Spanish last names in the United States who don't speak Spanish because their parents wanted them to speak only English. There are people like me who don't speak Yiddish, who come from Yiddish-speaking families because their grandparents and their parents wanted them to be 200% Americans with no taint of any accent. They believed that the language, the speaking of another language, would hurt their children. And you can see this all over the world. There are about 6,000 languages in the world. About 300 of them are spoken by a million people or more. So 5% of the languages are spoken by 95-97% of the people in the world. 95% of the languages are spoken by the rest of the people in the world. In other words, the diversity of human language and culture is under the stewardship, 95% of the diversity of human language and culture is under the stewardship of 3-5% of the people of the world. And that's vanishing.
And why do you think it's important to preserve that?
Well, that's a good question. One school of thought is that we don't need to worry about it at all. After all, neither the language of Jesus nor the language of Caesar is spoken today. So one school of thought is that it doesn't matter. After all, languages have always come and gone. And besides, we can translate languages, so we only need one. We just translate everything into English and we'll get everything. Well, there's a small problem for me with that. Because the proliferation of languages is the consequence of the peopling of the world from a few souls 40,000 years ago, modern Homo sapiens, in a couple of spots around the world, to every nook and cranny, every desert, mountain, seashore, every environmental Arctic and jungle, all the environmental niches, all the pieces of the world are populated from maybe a couple of million of us 40,000 years ago to going on soon 7 billion people. Well, that's a success story in terms of reproductive success. One way that we've been so successful is our ability to adapt to different environments, to learn about all the different conditions, know what foods there are, know what illnesses there are, know what cures those illnesses in the local environment, and then pass that on through language. In other words, culture is the adaptive mechanism of human beings, the essential adaptive mechanism. We don't swim very well, we don't see very well, we don't hear very well, we're certainly not very strong, we're not very fast, we're kind of puny in terms of as creatures, but our culture lets us really adapt to anything and dominate everything. We produce technology to adapt to culture, to adapt to local environments. And we continue to develop all those technologies and they continue to be very successful as a species. The proliferation of all those nooks, of all those successful pockets of people all over the world was accompanied by, and not caused by, but accompanied by a proliferation of all these languages. As people moved around the world, they developed all this linguistic variation. So we can't say that the language variation was the cause of any success, reproductive success. We can say that everything that people know about the world is stored in this database, in this enormous database of linguistic diversity. So, my position is that we just don't know whether or not this is going to hurt us or not. If we had, we're conducting an experiment to find out whether or not homogenizing the whole world's culture is going to hurt us as a species. Now, if I had 20 or 30 planets, and I could conduct an experiment 2,000-3,000 years, some planets I'd let the experiment run with people with diversity being preserved, run without, you know, being homogenized, and in 2,000 or 3,000 years I'd know the answer. I don't have the luxury of this. We're running this reckless experiment with just the one event. It's all one event. So my position is that I don't want to run that risk. And as we eliminate the cultural and linguistic diversity, as we eliminate all that linguistic diversity, we eliminate cultural diversity. We're playing with fire. We just don't know the outcome.
What's the work that you're proudest of?
Gee, I don't know. For the last 25 years, 26 years, I've been working on a project it's hard for me to be proud of anything, but I mean, I just don't like that, but I'm thrilled with it and what's going on and how things are progressing. We worked for a long time. The project actually stopped probably 10 years ago, but it's been picking up. There's more things happening. Our work was between 1986 and about 2000. That work is on something called the Network Scale-Up Method, NSUM, and some. The Network Scale-Up Method is a model for estimating the size of populations you can't count. The number of women who were raped in Seattle in 2011. The number of illegal immigrants in Chicago in 2012. The number of people who were killed as collateral damage in a war. The number of, just name lots and lots of populations you'd like to count. You'd like to know the size. The number of people at very high risk for AIDS in Rwanda. You can't count them. I mean, if you want to know the number of people who own a Toyota, you can take a random representative sample of a population and you can call them up and ask them, what car do you drive? They'll tell you. So one, you can find the population. Two, you can ask them the question. And three, they'll tell you the answer, and there's no stigma. For other populations, you can't do that. You can't call people up and ask them about certain kinds of things. This started with the 1985 Mexico City earthquake. How many people died in that earthquake? Well, I was walking around in the rubble just a few weeks after it was in the fall of 85. And it was, there were thousands of people that died, and no one knew how many. And there were conflicting figures. The government was saying one figure, and the journalists were saying other figures, but they had seen piles of bodies that were reported and weren't being reported. Other government figures, and there were a lot of conflicting numbers. In fact, it turns out that numbers are very political. Whatever the numbers are, some people want numbers to be large, and some people want numbers to be small. And somebody said to me, no one knows how many people died, but boy, there must be thousands because everybody I know knows somebody who died. So I had a macabre thought. I said, gee, we could actually test that. We could do a representative sample of Mexico City and ask people if they know anybody who died and find out the percentage of people who actually do know somebody who died. So we did. I ran a survey that did that. Anyway, now, in 2008, UNAIDS, it's in Geneva, at the World Health Organization, it's the United Nations research arm for the study of AIDS, causes and consequences of AIDS all around the world. And they do estimates in various countries around the world, as does the Global Fund for AIDS, to estimate the number of people who are at risk, who are injecting drug users, who are men having sex with men, who are who are engaged in the kind of behaviors that place them at risk for AIDS. And they ask whether or not we might be able to talk to them about doing this. So Christopher McCarty and I went and we gave a presentation, and people from various agencies from around the world were there. And since now, recently, last month in March, we went back, McCarty and I went back to New York, and there were people there from China, Japan, from Rwanda, from various countries, and there were people who were who had implemented the method in various countries, Moldova and Ukraine, a new generation. This is what's so thrilling, is that a new generation is picking this up and pushing the math forward and looking at the error bounds of the instrument. And so you've got people actually trying to use it to an application to help people, and you've got people in science doing the improving of the method. And to me, that's really thrilling. So the way the model works is we ask people how many people they know in a large number, 20, 30, populations whose size we know. People named Michael. We know how many people named Michael there are in the United States. There are counts of that. People who are registered gun shop owners. So we ask people the number of people they know in a large number of people, the populations whose size we know, and the number of people they know in populations whose size we don't know. The number of people who are homeless, the number of people who are homeless, people who've been raped, people who've been who are HIV positive, who are injecting drug users. Our hope is that the more accurate we can be with the populations whose size we know, because we can tell when we back estimate from that, the more confidence we have in the populations in our estimates of the populations whose size we don't know. We do really, really well on some populations, and we do really poorly on others. So, what are the sources of inaccuracy? There are two. One is called the barrier effects, and one is called the transmission effects. Barrier effects are physical and social barriers to knowing people. So, it's much more likely that somebody in Oklahoma knows an American Indian, if they themselves are not an American Indian, than somebody in New Jersey does. That's just because there's a big physical barrier of some miles between them, and a lot of people in Oklahoma who are American Indians. But the transmission effect is exactly what you just put your finger on. They know somebody who is an injecting drug user, but they don't know that about that person. So when you ask people, how many people do you know who has a twin? They say they know two or three, but they might know more. They just never found that out about the people they know. You can go for decades knowing people and not know that they have a twin. So there are lots of things that are stigma or just don't come up in conversation because they're trivial. So we're identifying the different transmission problems, including stigma. And what people are doing in several different places, what they did in Ukraine, for example, when they replicated this, they took all the populations and asked them, each person in the survey, national survey, to rate the stigma of each of the populations whose size we know. Okay? And now that's been replicated somewhere else. And so we're beginning to pile up data about what people in various places think is high or low stigma for various kinds of embedded populations. And as we get better, we hope that as we get better at estimating that, we'll hope that our estimates of the uncountable populations are also better.
What advice would you give to a young person interested in a career in science?
How could there be any advice other than to pursue it? How could you not? You'd be giving up so much if you did. The thrill of the hunt, constantly, you never know when you're going to run into somebody and some little spark is going to happen. Somebody's going to tell you how things work in this particular environment or in the lab, how things happen. Some spark is going to happen. You just never know. You're going to be walking around in the rubble in Mexico City and somebody's going to say something. And it'll just, you just never know. And how could you not want to pursue something that where knowledge making is what you do? And that's just a wonderful thing to do. So if people are interested in pursuing that, I would tell them, just do it. Don't try to think about what the costs might be. That's it.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.